There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away. So it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Welcome back to the Gear Talk, everyone. We have Giannis Boutelis and myself on, along with my buddy Kendall Card of Crispy Boots. We've hunted together a couple of times, Kendall.
Yeah, we've been in the mountains together, shared some experiences.
Fun times. We just wanted to have you hop on and talk with us about boots, which I think is going to be super fun.
Perfect. That's easy. I love talking boots.
Yeah. Can you give a little background on what you're doing now and a little bit of your boot background?
Yeah, you bet. We, as you know, and as people that might know me, I started in the hunting industry about 15 years ago, launched a website called Camel Fire. And through that and Black Ovis got involved eventually in Crispy. I've always been a gear guy, whether it's been rock climbing, mountaineering, backcountry skiing. Those have been some passions of mine since teenage years. So I've always been really just a gear nerd. I love geeking out on stuff. I love looking at not just looking at the manufacturing side, like why it's stitched this way or why it's built that way. But anyway, we got involved with Crispy through an unfortunate, but fortunate for me, situation with a previous distributor. Crispy has been around for about 50 years, but the distributor had only been established in the U.S. for about 3 or 4 years, and he made a couple of poor decisions that led to our opportunity to help Crispy kind of rejuvenate the brand, and then we've been North American distributor for Crispy for going on almost 8 years now.
When you say you have been the distributor, is that now Black Ovis is the main distributor, or...
Oh, good question. No. So we have a separate company called High Traverse Distribution. It's Crispy US. So it operates separately and actually in a separate building. It's about 30 miles difference between where Black Ovis and Camel Fire are from Crispy. So that's been interesting too, because even though I geeked out on gear and I felt like I really understood footwear as well as everything else, going into the factory and even just last week when I was in the factory and watching some of the manufacturing processes and understanding the why behind, little steps has really just been super enlightening and very interesting. And I continue to geek out on it. Even as much as I think I might know, there's still so much I don't know. So I love going into the factory setting and watching and learning the why behind how boots are built.
So then as a distributor, that's your main point of contact for Crispy. like, why is it important for you as just a distributor to know the boots themselves and not just know how to get them from point A to point B?
Super. Well, two things. That's a great question. Number one is obviously you can pretend, you know, and that's what I think some of the gripe behind. There's some retailers out there that simply just, I'll buy this product and I'll sell this product to somebody. And as a distributor, we could easily just send us whatever's on the menu. We'll bring it over and we'll sell it to whoever's, you know, wanting to buy it, whether we wholesale through like one of our partners like Black Ovis or Shields or Midway, or we direct sell it to a consumer. I think number one, just from an integrity standpoint, you have to understand the product you're selling, regardless of the brand. But number two, we work with the factory very differently than say like Scarpa or Zamberlin or some of the other really good boot makers, Hanwag and Loa. A lot of those companies that are based in Europe will essentially like, hey, this is the menu, this is the product selection we've developed. This is what you're available to offer if you're distributing in the U.S., for example, or if you're distributing in Australia. And they'll send that out to you. One thing that Crispy does, which is super unique, and it's funny because when we were there, they were building a boot for the Norwegian market, for the Scandinavian market. And we looked at it, it was like, hey, like it's kind of a little bit of FOMO, like, why can't we sell that boot? But we work with Italy in a way that we develop specific product for this market. And so in some way, we're helping to dictate the direction and the why, based on their foundational like building strategies. So our distributorship is a little different than a normal distribution company where we just happen to have a link with a factory. We buy it. We have an exclusivity in North America, and then we sell it. We get involved. And that's both because we're interested, as well as North America runs the gamut, I believe, in the hunting industry. Like we set the pace and we set the tone for the world. Not that, you know, we're better, but we just simply, from a trend and product development, you know, standpoint, maybe you guys might feel differently, but I think that Crispy Italy has recognized the North American market is that pace setter. And so they've allowed us, you know, honestly allowed us to work with them in a very unique way.
Let's go back to that special boot though, real quick. Would it be the same way? Like if you developed a special boot for this market, then they wouldn't let it go to other markets. Like you'd have some sort of exclusivity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like there's a number of boots, like the Idaho, the Wyoming, the Brickstall SF that we just created, the Brickstall Pro, Jordan, I think you might've had a chance to use that boot.
Mm-hmm.
Those boots are unique to the North American market only. So even though some of our hunting brethren in New Zealand and Australia would love to get their hands on those, they can't distribute that boot. So they might take some of the main established boots like the Guide or the Nevada, the Hunter, and utilize those in their markets.
Hmm.
It's unique because most manufacturing companies, like, let me go back to Scarpa is just down the road from us in Italy. And our hotel was literally across the street. So like Scarpa, for example, would not, you know, build a boot and say, okay, you can only sell that. You know, only the U.S. market is exclusive on that. They typically will, it's worldwide, or there might be some trends that would dictate one boot in one area, one boot in another area, or like Slewa.
Well, yeah, it seems limiting to the company.
It kind of does, doesn't it? And we've had some interesting back and forth with Italy on... And from a business standpoint, it's like I'd almost rather see some boots get worldwide distribution to kind of raise the tide for all. But I think there's it's really a cool relationship with the president and the son of the founder. And he, when we develop a boot with him, he often looks at it like this. I want you guys to benefit from the collaboration of the build. And some of them, you know, he's come back to us a few times and said, hey, the Norwegians really love this boot, or the guys in New Zealand, can we, and we're like, yeah, go for it. Or sometimes we're like, man, we'd like to hang on to that boot. We've spent a lot of time in development and working with you on sampling and tweaking and testing and stuff like that. So It is. It's super unique, and I don't. Some ways I don't understand why they allow us to do it that way versus how a lot of other boot companies do function. But I'm certainly grateful for the relationship, and it creates a tighter bond with us, and also I think it creates a tighter bond with the product that we're offering to hunters in North America. And we know those products inside and out because we've been through the development process on most every one of them.
Sweet.
Got it. Well, that's a good lead into one of our first questions here. And I think it's good. I think we should try to stick to it, which I'm sure you will, because I think that's mostly what Crispy makes. Which, by the way, Kendall, I have never, ever, I've never even skied in a pair of Crispy boots. So I need to change that. But we're going to be referencing like a standard hunting boot, I think, that, you know, could be used Midwest, out West, wherever. Like, that's kind of what we're talking about here when we're talking about when Kendall's answering these questions. We're not talking about, you know, rubber, you know, type boots that you might use whitetail deer hunting for scent control, but like a more of a standard mountain hunting boot. So that being said, Kendall, give us like the 10,000 foot view as quick as we can of like the general makings of a boot, like the parts and pieces, and then we'll try to break it down from there.
Yeah, you bet. When you see an upper, so I'm talking everything. So the various ingredients for a boot, you've got the sole and then you have a midsole. And oftentimes people just think the sole and the midsole are one and the same, but they're very different. The sole is, if you took the sole off of a boot, it'd be completely floppy, like a New York pizza. It's a slice that just super floppy.
When you say sole, that's the bottommost part layer of the boot.
Yeah, the tread. So if you look at most boots, the color, there's a coloration change between the sole and the midsole, ever so slightly. Even if you've got like a dark gray or a black, you can see that. So it's just that bottom tread. And when a guy or gal takes a boot in to get resold, what they're talking about is they'll take a knife, literally a knife. I mean, I've seen these things. They're like 12, 14 inches long. The kind of handles on both sides, or on some of them I've seen. And they'll cut that sole off and replace just the tread. So basic elements, the sole, you've got the midsole, and that's composited of various different materials. You might have a midsole that's EVA, which is a foam of various densities. You might have injection molded, which is a way that you can build boots faster and less expensive. A lot of like your boots out there, like let's say like a Salomon Quest 4D or some of the Salewa, even some of the Zamberlin. You look at, and these are more kind of active, like a running shoe. That's an injection molded. It's a lot cheaper to do. And usually that is a EVA foam. So then you have polyurethane, which is a more dense, heavier, material that's used in midsoles. And Vibram makes most of those. You do have some other companies that might make some, strategically for their own, you know, manufacturing. Crispy uses a lot of Vibram product. In fact, we have a partnership with Vibram. And some of our midsoles are exclusive to us, and some of them, like there's a midsole that we use on the Brickstall, which is used on, Schnee's uses it. I've seen it on a couple other boots, like throughout Europe. So it's not, there isn't typically a midsole that's made out of PU or out of EVA, if it's being done by the Vibram company that is exclusive. So we have a couple that are exclusive, and then others we use universally that other brands can certainly buy from Vibram and use. But the polyurethane midsole is kind of the other option. The other piece of that is then you get to the upper, and the upper.
Well, real quick, Kendall, before you get to the upper, just so. I'm imagining a boot in my head and I can see the bottom tread part and I'm following you there. It's like real skinny. And then you have the midsole. As like a consumer that just picks up a boot in the store, what am I looking at? Or like, is there any way to sort of put midsole into more context other than it's just another layer there?
The two things that you can do is look at, you'll see coloration, and its coloration changes within a midsole. Sometimes will be design oriented, but most of the time it's differentiating different densities or the how firm or how soft a midsole might be. So a consumer, if I'm looking at a shelf in, let's say, Sportsman's or Scheels, and I pull one off the shelf, and I can kind of poke at different areas of the midsole, whether I'm using my finger or, like, you know, the end of a pen, something that would tell me, like, what is this? How soft is this midsole, or how hard is this midsole? And is it soft in certain areas or harder in other areas? That's one thing you could do. The other thing that you'll see on a midsole, if you're just looking, is sometimes you'll be able to determine the type of material. I'm talking polyurethane versus EVA, based on the look. EVA has a kind of a distinguishing look, or on weight, overall weight. EVA, like if you put on a pair of running shoes, I mean, that EVA is so light. I mean, you put on a pair of running shoes and you're like, oh my gosh, these things are unbelievable. They're so lightweight. But that foam, because it doesn't have as much rebound over a long period of time, that's why, you know, after running a pair of running shoes, you know, you after a year, you might not even use those shoes to mow the lawn in, because they're so basically packed out or compressed. But other guys, so if you're a consumer, you can look at coloration differences, or you can look at, or you can feel differences in the midsole being like more squishy in one area and less squishy, or more hard and soft in different areas.
Just so I'm clear too, the outsole obviously is for the grip, and the main purpose of the midsole is what?
It's cushioning and absorption of impact. You'll look at different thicknesses. So for example, we have a boot called the Thor, and we have a boot called the Summit, and they both use dual density, two different densities EVA, but one is thinner and one is thicker. So performance wise, what you're going to feel, or if you look across any other hunting brands, you'll see some that are really thick and some that are thinner. Two things that's going to affect. Number one is the midsole is there to absorb impact. So as you're hiking with a 50-pound pack for X number of miles over X number of hunts, the goal for that midsole is to absorb as much of that impact as possible so that it doesn't get transferred into your body. We're talking joints, back, hips, et cetera, as well as because, you know, it's, you know, and then you've got guys that are like, oh, yeah, I just use, you know, like the Vibram Five Fingers. It's like, I'm all into that whole, like, humans didn't have shoes to begin with crowd. It's like, wait a second. So the midsole is both absorption, and then that is dictated by both thickness and material density and type of material.
And then I imagine that the midsole is also what designates the stiffness of the boot.
Not entirely. What's interesting is when we're talking, if we jump into stiffness and what the midsole does or doesn't do, the midsole can influence how a boot may flex, but everything else around the boot does as well. And that's one of the light bulb moments that I've had in my progression of learning boot manufacturing. I always thought that it was the midsole, which is not necessarily the case. It's the next layer that you go up in, which in some boots they put a shank. You've heard people say, oh, we've got a metal shank or a composite shank, or we've got what we call in our boot construction a board last, which is the length of the boot. It looks very similar to like an insole, but that goes between the midsole and then the upper part of the boot, and that, based on, again, density, type of material, thickness of material, different zones, like maybe at the ball of the foot, it might be thinner, whereas the heel, it might be thicker. It might taper in the arch of the foot. That is the primary designator of how stiff a boot might flex. But the one thing that changed my perspective was that the midsole does come into play. The depth, the how deep the tread is on the sole does come into play. If you're using a sole, it's more like a running shoe or a trail running shoe, versus a boot, you can obviously see the different depth of the rubber. So you've got more substance. Obviously, you know, more substance is going to flex, be more stiff. But the upper part of the boot, we're talking like the leather or synthetic or combination, whatever you're using on the upper does also change the flex. So it's like every ingredient makes the recipe, but there's one ingredient that dictates the primary base of the recipe when you're talking stiffness or flex of the boot. And I had always discounted the upper. I never thought that the upper had that much influence, but we have like a rating system, and other brands have come up with different rating systems. We have boots that use the exact same sole, midsole, and the stiffness of the board last that dictates the flex. Mm-hmm. And because we use upper materials, you know, hunters will try them on and say, oh, this one's definitely softer flex than this one. You're like, they're actually the exact same. The only difference is the upper material and construction and stitching here or there, that sort of thing.
So the upper will actually, I'm trying to think how to put this in words, but the upper will control how much those bottom three layers can flex.
In some ways, yes. Or it influences. I wouldn't say control, I would say influences. What controls the main flex is going to be that board last or that shank, or, you know, depending on the manufacturer, whatever they design into sitting on top of the midsole, but beneath the upper material, be it leather or be it synthetic.
Would you be stepping on the board last if you took the insole out?
Yeah, you would. The only thing that would separate you from the board last or from that stiffening element, whatever, you know, other manufacturers might call it, is typically a small felt or very thin material in a boot that's Gore-Tex. You've obviously got the Gore-Tex booty, but it's little to nothing. And so sometimes people, if the board last or the shank or whatever is thicker, or there's a lot of substance there, that's why sometimes people might say, yeah, these boots are comfortable, they fit my feet, but I feel it, like, feels like it's hard underneath my foot. And maybe that's a response of the midsole, you know, the insole is not very cushioning. But if in the absence of a board last, in the absence of anything that is trying to dictate the flex, and you simply just have the upper and then a midsole, it's going to feel whatever that midsole feels. That's back to my running shoe. If you're in a running shoe or if you're in a lightweight hunting boot, like a Salomon or Salewa, or even like our Ativa Mid, that board last is so thin or not, or basically non-existent, that you're feeling the foam at various densities of that midsole. And so you might find, man, I love these because they're more comfortable, but there's nothing or very little to dictate like strength of flex or, you know, how much you want the boot to control, you know, your stance on the mountainside.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Let's continue then moving upwards. Yeah. So we got the kind of the bottom, even though it only looks like the bottom 10th of the boot, it's more like the bottom half. But going up from there, where do you even start?
It's super interesting when you, and I've asked, so where you start on the upper part of the boot is you're looking at raw materials. So like in the Crispy Warehouse, and I'm sure at Scarpa and our friends at Zamberlin down the road as well, you're looking at leathers, you're looking at rolls. So you've got rolls of leather of various thicknesses, various just the feel, the touch. You've got a full grain leather that might be real hard, like a briefcase, you know, a thick stout briefcase might be, you know, out of leather, or you've got some really soft, super pliable, and you're taking those, the various materials, or you're looking at a synthetic. Like we use a microfiber synthetic. It's a full synthetic material that we're introducing in a new boot for 2023. Joe, I don't know if you've had a chance to test that one, Jordan.
No,
nope.
But
okay.
I want to.
Yeah, I know you do. So it's one I've been testing this fall, and it looks just like a leather, but it's because we've brushed the outer. Because sometimes you get those synthetic materials that look like just cheap plastic. So you've got various materials, and so you're taking those and you're stamping out or laser cutting that material, and then you're merging that with, you know, either some padding or a mesh liner or a Gore-Tex booty or a waterproof breathable booty. And you're taking all those things and you're sewing then the tongue and the, you know, the rivets, and all those pieces get built until it looks like a flattened shoe, because obviously it hasn't been merged with the lower. And they come out of the sewing area, and it's pretty interesting. It's quite fascinating to watch it go from stamped leather or synthetic to the first stage of sewing to the rivets or the eyelets being, you know, punched and applied to then the underside material, which is all the padding that we feel. Otherwise, you'd have a moccasin effect. To then going into the process where they start merging the upper to the lower elements. It's fascinating. It's super fascinating, and it's fun.
Can you give us that? Can you give us that process in a concise answer? Like, is that possible? Even to tell us how upper gets fused to the bottom?
So yeah, two things that happen. Number one is you take that kind of that. It's all not quite pancake flat, but it's mostly flat shoe upper. Leather or synthetic, it comes over to the manufacturing line, and they put the booty in this sense, when we're using Gore-Tex, it's a full booty. So that actually is the first time that it starts looking like a lower, like a shoe or a boot, and that comes into a machine that basically it pulls the tongue out and wraps it around what's called a last. And in any boot building, you have to have a shape that you're going to take that flat upper and form it to. So the last is it's best described as like shoe trees that you put like in dress shoes.
Mm-hmm.
They're super lightweight. Well, the last is stupid heavy. I mean, you pick one up and it's like, oh my gosh. And you watch these guys in the manufacturing line picking these up and moving them around. And the last pivots right in the middle. And so it's a two-part that has a little bit of pivot to it. And you put that last into the like the booty, and then the upper gets shaped around that and start through heat as well as pulling, as well as utilizing a, like either a plastic. A lot of manufacturers use a bigger plastic on the toe cap and on the heel cap. That's why when you're walking on the trail and you kick a rock, you know, you don't, oftentimes you don't feel it, is because there's got some reinforcement in there. And those elements are then put around the last and it's shaped finally so that it can be prepared for then putting the lower on the midsole and the sole. And there's a bunch of different little processes that happen where you know, because if you're taking a flat item and wrapping around a roundish item, being the last or the shape of your foot, then you're going to have little bubbles or you're going to have like folds in the leather. And all those get sanded down or ground. If you're putting on like a rand, like a rubber rand, you'll prep that with a little bit of tape. And in our processing, this is all done by hand. So they're literally taking what looks like a paintbrush, dipping it in a glue, prepping that area, that zone, and then it goes down the chain. And the rand gets applied, and then it gets put onto the sole midsole. So that starting process is done both by hand as well as by machine in various pulling and shaping to finally get in with glue to get that to become, you know, a boot or looking like a boot. And that process differs depending on the manufacturing. If you're looking at some of the Asian factories that are more less hands-on and more like your injection molding that midsole, that is a faster process, usually less expensive. In our process and some of the other Italian manufacturers that are still doing it by hand, it's very much like the person's taking the last, they're slipping that upper and the Gore-Tex booty around it, almost like you're putting a sock on. They're shaping it, pushing it, pulling it tight, making sure that it's all like, you know, aligned properly, and then it goes into that first machine. And even though it's a machine, there's two little joysticks that the guy, and he's got these foot pedals, and that all dictates the pressure of pulling everything around the tongue out tight enough and everything around the heel tight enough and snug enough until finally they see it's aligned perfectly, it's pulling at the right pressures. And then they basically push a button and it forms it around the last. And so it becomes the shape of a shoe. And it's fascinating to watch. And it's really, I mean, I couldn't tire of just sitting there and watching the, because each model is also different and requires different alignment and different pressures. So we're in the U.S. and we bring someone into a company that's building, and it's like, man, we got to get you up to speed in two, three months. You better be drilling or making these rivets or cutting these boards or whatever manufacturing you're doing. Well, in Italy, there's many times where I'll be on the factory and I'm like, oh man, this guy looks like he's doing good. They're like, oh, he's still an apprentice. He's only been here 5 years, and we don't let him use like that machine and that machine. He still needs supervision for that. And you're like, what? And so the philosophy or the approach to hand-built boots or handcrafted boots is so different than, and the skill and the amount of detail is more than you might think, is what I'm saying.
Dang.
Yeah, it's it brings up so much. You're like, why it costs so much? Why it costs so much to make something like that? And then how much like wear and tear we put through it. But let's get to that in a little bit. I think that was a good segue. I feel like we understand how a boot's made now, but this is a good segue into the waterproof, breathable conversation, because you mentioned like a Gore-Tex booty inside of a boot. And I think you hear that a lot. Jordan and I get questions about it a lot. Like, how is it that a boot can actually be waterproof? How does that work? How come boots aren't waterproof after a season sometimes? So let's go ahead and dive into that. Tell me about how that Gore-Tex booty or other breathable membrane booty, how that fits into a boot to make it waterproof.
Yeah, really, really good question. And there are, just because you have to know that just because the it says Gore-Tex or whatever other branded product that is out there doesn't necessarily mean that it's an entire bootie. There are a lot of manufacturing, uh-huh. a lot of boots and shoes that may utilize Gore-Tex, but only on the upper and then down around. And it kind of, instead of coming full circumference, it might just tuck around the bottom and basically end just on the edge of the midsole underneath. And that's done. It's done. And you might question, and I question, like, why on earth wouldn't you just do a full bootie? The one of the main reasons is cost and skill. It's harder. It's much harder to ensure that the Gore bootie remains with full integrity throughout the entire manufacturing process than if you're only using that upper piece. So basically, the top part of the boot is covered. For example, I was in that process where you take the Gore bootie, the upper gets attached to it, and then it gets shaped around the last. The next step is you're putting the board last, or that platform that determines flex. You're gluing that or attaching that to the bottom of the bootie. One of the things that I was observing last week in the factory was if you place that, think about where the toe of the foot is. And if just under the toe, that board last looks like the insole of the shoe. So it's same shape, and that's being applied to the bottom of the Gore bootie to then sit on top of the midsole. So if you place that too close to the nose of basically the end of the toes, then what happens is when you pull the upper around and you're shaping that so that it forms the toe of the boot, it will pinch that Gore bootie. It may pinch that in if the board last is sticking out too far. If it's sticking too far back, you get movement of the Gore, too much movement in that Gore bootie, and it might stretch and again get pinched. So I watched Federico, the president of Crispy. We were sitting there, and the young man that was doing that process, he had been in there 3 or 4 years, and that was his lone area. And he literally took a couple of them and said, nope, this isn't right. And I'm talking like he moved it millimeters, maybe a millimeter or two forward. And he showed like how that could be pinched. So the one thing that everyone needs, regardless of what material you're using, Gore or another membrane, the reality is those membranes are so fragile. Like a scratch with your finger, like a hard scratch at your fingernail could cause that Gore membrane to be compromised.
Now the Gore membrane is that's when they're putting it into that boot, it's not just that. I'm imagining that it's with some other layers to make it a little bit tougher, right?
It typically will have on the inside, like when you open up a boot that is utilizing Gore, you'll see like a little felt, like a little fabric, layer that the Gore is attached to. That's why, like on a ski jacket, you'll see, you're actually not. You'll see like an inner layer that's attached, yeah. And that's to protect, so you don't get the friction like from the inside of the boot. But on the outside of the boot, one of the things that you can't on the outside of that Gore layer, you can't. There's certain regulations when you're using Gore. Like because you're like, well, if it's so fragile, then just put a nice solid layer of just something that prohibits any sort of scratch or any sort of penetration of a thorn or whatever. There's limitations to what you can do because you have not just the waterproofness that you're trying to protect the foot, but you also have breathability that you're trying to ensure. So if you start to cover that Gore membrane with a pile of other things, then you start inhibiting the breathability aspect or the water vapor to escape. And then Gore, so we have an area of our factory, and every Gore partner would have a part of their factory or the ability for Gore to come in and say, hey, we want to pull and test some of these products, or we want to ensure that within your manufacturing, you're not preventing breathability, but you're also protecting waterproofness and taking care to the Gore membrane. So the process of utilizing gore or a waterproof breathable membrane is very it's a very delicate process, and it has to be done with precision. So that kind of leads into, well, how come my boots got wet after, why did my feet get wet after X number of years or X number of uses? Because of the fragility of the gore membrane, there's going to be, and specifically if you're looking at manufacturing process, there's bound to be a lemon here and there. It's just part of the deal. There's an area we have where pallets of boots get pulled off of the manufacturing as they finally finish and box them. And there's a gal that she takes boots, and we actually have a little video we took. And this happens in most any manufacturing that is going to guarantee waterproofness. They'll take water, they pour it into the boot, and then weigh it, and then they put it in a machine that spins it. I forget the terminology for that type of machine. I want to say centrifuge, but I don't think that's it. But and then they spin that for a certain period of time, and then they're trying to see, will the pressure built up from that spinning push water out of that membrane? Will the membrane maintain its integrity? And there's times where just in that manufacturing process we get to that point where we're randomly testing and then boom, we find a leaking boot. It's not to say that some, you know, one slips through the crack and a guy gets a boot and first time it leaks, which is why everyone that uses a membrane like that will guarantee for a period of time. But you have to remember, if you're not using a full booty, over time, as you flex the boot a zillion times and you're hiking to and fro, hunting hard or hunting soft, there's going to be the ability for water to really try and penetrate in between the bottom of the boot and the midsole in the seams. And eventually, if you're not using a full booty, that's where some weaknesses can take place. But also eventually, you know, if you're using a boot just hard, there you run the risk, depending on the upper material, of something penetrating or something degrading that membrane in some sort of way that it causes a leak.
Rocks is what comes to mind. Like a lot of abrasion resistance, like right on the side of your foot.
Side of your foot is one location. The second location that people don't think about, depending on the material, the upper, you look across, like Salewa and Scarpa have a lot of synthetic boots. Crispy uses a number of boots. The one that you know you've used, Jordan, the Brickstall SF, and the Brickstall uses a soft shell type material. It's a stretch nylon in the tongue. I know you know companies like Schnee's, Kennetrek uses straight up leather in their tongue. Some of our models are straight up leather. So depending on the material you're using, down in the tongue area, if you've never taken your boots like legitimately apart, like pulled the laces out and taken a toothbrush and cleaned out that area, if you're in particularly like sheep hunting terrain, or you're in areas where you're getting a lot of small stones and grit in down in that tongue, as soon as that stuff gets, because it happens when you're walking across a glacial stream, like you step in and kind of the fine, you know, little rocks, they kind of surface up around your foot. And that settles down in that crease. Or if you're side hilling a lot in a lot of like shale, you'll get little stones in there. And if not cleaned out over time, it basically becomes sandpaper, and it's just rubbing and rubbing and rubbing and rubbing down in that groove. You may not feel it because it's small enough, but eventually, depending on the material, like the Kennetrek, their tongue is full leather. The guide, the guide Nevada from Crispy, the Schnee's boot, they have a couple that use the full leather. That's not going to get broken down, but you start using a synthetic tongue that's thinner, and that gore membrane is basically almost to the surface. Over time, that's a weakness that's going to indicate is going to break down if you're not cleaning that area out on the regular.
Could you give like a 30-second synthetic versus leather?
Yeah, the primary.
That's impossible.
30 seconds. Well, for me, I know 30 seconds is impossible.
I don't think anybody could do that.
The rationale for synthetic over leather is weight savings and typically drying out faster or repelling water, having the ability to repel water, being hydrophobic. Leather inherently will absorb water. It's just what happens. That's why we treat leather boots. But leather will prevent penetration of things. Synthetic will typically breathe better. Leather may not. So there's pros and cons, but I would say leather is a weight savings, sometimes a cost savings, and a breathability enhancement over a leather. But leathers, it's old reliable. I was shocked. Is my 30 seconds up? Because I'm going to switch topics a little bit.
Yeah, switch it.
Shocked at, you know, I'm here in Utah and I hunt in Utah, and I don't mind running. I mean, in some places I hate running into people, but I actually love running into people in the mountains because I'm always studying like what gear they're using. And I invariably look at boots. I mean, it's my kids like, Dad, stop looking at what shoes people are wearing. Here in Utah, I'll see guys wearing all sorts of stuff from Hoka to Salomon trail runners to full on, like, you know, 10 inch stiff boots, Kennetrek guy, you know, Schnees or Crispies. And it's interesting to see what people what they'll get away with, right? In various weather, or if you're just day hunting, kind of in and out real quick, you'll go maybe lighter weight shoe. I went into Wyoming this year on an archery elk hunt, and it was horseback. And we ran into piles of dudes. I guess that's like everywhere anymore on general tag, but what shocked me is every single person had full leather boots. Everyone. And I probably saw 25 guys from a Forest Service guy that I bumped into, to an outfitter, to clients, to just Joe regular out hunting like me, local, non-local. Every single person had a full leather boot, and it shocked me. But then at the same time, I thought, man, I'm 12 miles in on horseback in rugged elk country. Why wouldn't I be in a full leather boot? Because I know that that's reliable. I mean, I know exactly what I'm going to get, and it's tough as nails. There's fewer seams. So it's it was interesting to me to see that difference between zones of hunting and the type of boot that people were relying upon. And then most of those guys are in there for, you know, a week at a time kind of thing versus kind of popping in, popping out on a day hunt.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Switching gears a little bit, going back to that membrane, that Gore-Tex membrane.
Mm-hmm.
Does that thing breathe? Like, is that what determines breathability? I know there's some other factors around it, but, and like, can you give a overview of like a boot breathing? Like, what does it mean?
You have to come to like, what does a breathability mean? And it varies based on each person, whatever they desire for it. So when you say breathability, some people might think like, man, my sweatshirt breathes. Like I can put my mouth up to it and blow through it and feel the wind. Yeah, it's, you know, or my performance layers. When you get into footwear, it breathes in that water vapor is transferring through the membrane and dispelling or moving away from the from that membrane, whether it be through synthetic material or through leather material. But there's a capacity that which, and the same thing with rain gear. Like you look at waterproof, breathable, man, you know, rain gear. At some point, there's a limit capacity. It's all physics of movement of water vapor through a barrier or how much pressure. You know, that also dictates like how much pressure is behind that movement or is the boot completely filled up? How much water is being expelled by the human foot? So there becomes a point at which people might say, users will say, dude, this boot doesn't breathe for crap, or the sock I'm using might dictate some of that moisture transfer, not through the boot, but up the sock, up the shaft of the leg and away, you know, through that material. So, it's kind of a relative term, breathability, but indeed both through scientific testing of the Gore membrane as well as other membranes, they do breathe, but to a degree. If you've got insulation on the outside of that Gore membrane between that and the outer of the boot, again, it's going to affect breathability, of course, because there's more passageway for the moisture to leave the boot itself. But yeah, from a simply a science and testing standpoint, absolutely the Gore membrane does breathe. The other challenge is that Jordan, your foot, and Giannis, your foot, and my foot all breathe and biologically behave differently. And so our conclusions might be completely different based on is that boot or is that foot, is that shoe breathable?
Yeah.
From a waterproofing standpoint, like how much would you say, like if you could break it down percentage wise, and you're taking a boot that does have a membrane of sorts, and it obviously has then the outer fabric, and I'm guessing it might have a durable water repellent finish on the outside as well. Or if it's a leather boot, then you might have, you know, Nick Wax, whatever you've applied to it. How much is it the outer material of the boot and what's applied to the actual outside that is causing the waterproofness versus the membrane on the inside?
Yeah, real good question. The membrane itself is ultimately like, if you're talking responsibility, you know, who done it, who's responsible. The membrane is ultimately responsible for your foot to stay dry. The outer material and what it's treated with, synthetic being treated with like a spray or some sort of, you know, some sort of DWR, durable water repellency. Those are temporary, of course, as you guys know, and many listeners might know that that's a temporary treatment. Even on the cream that you put on a leather, whether it be Nick Wax or whatever, beeswax that I know that, like Kennetrek uses a beeswax based, we use a synthetic based cream. Nick Wax is a water based cream. All of those creams have a certain life to them, and those are responsible more for keeping that. Everything from the Gore membrane out, we're talking the Gore membrane, the insulation layer, and then the leather or the synthetic, typically a topical applied element is responsible for keeping that part dry, whereas the gore membrane itself is responsible for keeping the foot dry. But they do work in tandem. There's no doubt that you know, if you're walking through a pile, you know, just a super heavy dew morning as you're cutting through a meadow to head up above timberline, you're hunting deer in Colorado or elk. If your outer material, the leather or the synthetic, is just immediately soaking in water, it's going to create more pressure against the gore membrane. And so as you become water soaked and you're when you flex, you're creating pressure points where water is getting a higher pressure. So as you flex the boot or as you exercise, you know, movement in that boot under a lot of exterior water, there's going to be more pressure on that membrane for water, you know, the water repellency to be compromised, or basically water to push through that. And so the outer certainly works. Those outer applications help to work in tandem with the membrane inside.
Whew. There's a lot there.
Sorry.
There's a lot there. No, all good. I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And I mean, when you've talked to hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of people about boots, you feel like you heard it all. You know, from the first few years with Crispy as a distributor, we were answering every single phone call. And now we've got, you know, a small team and we still, but you go to shows and you hear everything, you see everything. It boggles Crispy Italy. And I would probably say other manufacturers are kind of surprised, or, you know, especially if they come from a European non-hunting focused background. If you look at like Kennetrek or Schnaes, those were built by hunters for hunters, and hunting is the market. You look at Crispy, hunting is our primary market, and we do some outdoor. You look at Scarpa though, or Hanwag, or Salewa, Loa, those brands did not start as hunting companies. And so their customer use is outdoor hikers and trekkers and climbers and scramblers and skiers and et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at like the abuse that, and Giannis, you mentioned this earlier, when you look at the abuse that hunters put on boots compared to the other user groups, it's astounding. And Crispy, I know, looks at we'll send some boots over there, like, I can't believe this has only been used for 13 days on a single hunt and just shredded. And so it's because we're all, you know, it's not because we're so hardcore and we're just, you know, we're just so tough, because there's plenty of, like, you know, hard men in the climbing and other worlds, but the where we use our boots and shoes and how we rely on them pushes the envelope, I think. And that's what's cool about working so closely with the factory, is we start seeing, you know, and other manufacturers that are hunting specific start to see that serious abuse, and they make changes based on the things that are happening and testing different materials and finding weaknesses. And so, unfortunately, sometimes customers on the front end get, you know, they might use it in an extreme situation or an undesigned situation and find weaknesses. And it's like, it's a bummer, but it's more enlightening for a boot manufacturer to say, oh my gosh, this failed. No way this failed. I did, like, you know, I use a certain type of thread to stitch that. There's no way that was going to fail. And then Jordan takes it to Alaska and just destroys it. And we're like, dang, Jordan, sorry about that, but thank you. That's a fun, you know, so anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but it's an interesting observation that I know that we have experienced. And I would suspect that other brands, primarily the Italian brands and the European brands, are starting to experience, because hunters are typically a heavier user, not in weight, but just in the extremes where we go with boots, because we don't walk by trails, we just walk by mountains.
I mean, we could talk about this forever, but as we come up on our time, is there like a something that we can give our listeners as like a takeaway of, if you're going to go into Shields or wherever and you're going to look at a boot for a specific hunt, what would you tell listeners looking for a boot?
Yeah, two things. The first thing I would say is take whatever the guy at the store or your buddy or you read on Rockslide or you saw on YouTube, take that with a grain of salt because, like I mentioned before, biologically, all of us are different. We have our intricacies as well as our feet are all designed differently. And so just because a boot is like the cat's meow for your buddy or some guy on YouTube said that or some review you read doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the same result for you. So as you start to look at the various manufacturers and the various designed purposes of each boot, narrow down your selection based on what you feel. And I know that's impossible for some people because they live in Timbuktu and they just have to mail order or call in or you know, hop on a website and buy some. So it's hard to narrow that down. So doing your homework, I don't think you can do enough homework on footwear. And understand that, you know, sometimes you may swing and you think you hit it over the fence and the left fielder jumps over the fence and snatches that and you're out. And the boot you thought was going to be the home run is not the home run and it doesn't work. And that's a tough lump to swallow when a boot's $300, $400, $500. Yeah. But the second piece, so anyway, take all that information as processed information that you're gathering, not necessarily as the gospel truth. But the second piece is start to identify, look closely at some of the things we've talked about, the materials in the upper, the midsole thickness, the tread depth, the type of products, whether it be Vibram, Gore, a synthetic versus leather. Look at those things and start to like match those. What's the use of each of those materials? What's the purpose of each of those materials? And what is the type of terrain or the type of use that I'm going to be utilizing them in? And start to consider that rather than just slip your foot in and like, oh, that feels good. I'll take them. And so as you start to educate yourself a little bit on some of the things we've talked about, these different materials that are put into the boot, you'll start to understand, okay, leather has this performance, synthetic has this performance. Well, what am I really looking for? And I've had some of those kind of conversations with guys and they're like, man, my buddy loves this boot over here, but for some reason I wanted to love that boot so hard, but this one over here is that's the one, that's my Cinderella slipper that I've been looking for. And I don't know why, but, and it's so much lighter or it's a softer flex than my buddy. And we hunt the same terrain and just get over the fact that you might be in a softer flex, less burly of a boot and cover the same terrain as your buddy who's in something super thick, but start to analyze like what goes into each boot as you really narrow down your selection and then make sure that you get your foot in it and walk around, whether it be in that store. You know, if you've got to buy 7 boots on the internet and return all 7, just know that process is worth the pain. And just tell your wife you're going to carry a little balance on the credit card if that's what it takes, because ultimately nothing would destroy a hunt more than crappy footwear or footwear that doesn't match your performance need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super subjective. I like to choose boots based on color scheme sometimes. Just kidding.
Go for it. I didn't. You've never struck me as that kind of personality, Jordan, but I thought we were turning over a new leaf there in our friendship.
when you were talking about going to the backcountry and everybody was wearing leather boots, I was like, I would be the one you'd see with orange boots.
Oh, yeah.
I used to have a pair of those bright blue La Sportiva. I think they were called Glaciers. Remember mm-hmm. those?
Yep.
And yeah, I got a lot of crap for having blue boots.
You got some looks?
Yeah. Kendall, question for you. If... let's say it's the same boot from your manufacturer, because you'll be answering this question for Crispy. But if it's the same boot and it's like in a smaller size, like say a, you know, 7, 8, 9, where the average person is going to, let's say, weigh 140, 150 pounds in that boot versus that same boot in a size 12, where that average person might weigh closer to 190 or 200, does the flex change, or like I would imagine it might get stiffer to accommodate for the heavier person, or is that flex going to feel the same if you had a a flex rating machine, is it going to feel the same in that size 8 or 9 as it does in the 12?
Dude, that might be, I'm going to have to give you an award because that might be the coolest question I've ever been asked about footwear. I'm not kidding. That is a super interesting question.
Well, you know how, like you're saying, you run into people and you're like, man, you're running around the mountains in a pair of trail runners. I've tried it because I listen, I can tell everybody out there with certainty that you can sneak up to an elk way easier in a pair of trail runners than you can in a pair of stiff mountain boots. It's just like a fact.
Oh yeah.
The cushion just soaks up stuff underneath your feet and you're just like a little, you know, ghost ninja slipping through the timber. But my weight just puts way too much torque, I guess, onto my feet and my ankles that halfway through the day, I can't take a trail runner. So I need a little bit. So anyways, but back to the question, like, I think that some people that are lighter weight can get away with a lighter, more flexible boot because their weight isn't asking so much of the boot where I might need a little more support. So does a manufacturer accommodate for that?
The answer is no. I think we use the same materials from size to size. So the same amount, I mean, the same exact materials are going to be used in an 8 versus in a 12, but by mere fact that you have less material or suppose rationally, you know, the ratio of material to size is going to be equal. I would say that the flex, if you could test it, which I'm super intrigued actually, if you could test the flex of a 12 versus a flex of the 8 and weigh that testing machine, if you could, based on 200 versus 140, my guess is, and I don't know the answer, I don't know the right answer, but my guess is that the 8 might feel a little stiffer because of less force, or, you know, you're talking on a cantilever, you have only 140 pounds versus 100 or 200 pounds. I would suspect that there's probably going to be a little bit more stiff flex on that smaller one. And I'd love to know if there's a physicist out there or someone that's a mechanic, you know, into physics and mechanics, I'd love to have someone shed some light on that particular thought. But from a standpoint, the second part you just asked, from a standpoint of a bigger guy, I mean, I'm 195, 6'4", I'm a tall guy. I feel like I know that I get better performance out of just, I'm talking feel good, out of a thicker midsole, a polyurethane midsole versus out of a thin trail running type sole. And I feel it 2 or 3 days later. And I know that on a multi-day hunt, I don't recover as quickly after, you know, big day exertions. Whereas I think guys that are running that are lighter weight, it may not impact them as much if they're not, you know, with the same or maybe even going a softer midsole material. But man, that is, you've ignited an interest in me, a thought process that I'm sure I'm not going to sleep at night for a while on this one. This is cool.
Well, if you're out there listening and you have a lead or an answer for us, please write into geartalk@themeateater.com and you know, tell us what you know and we'll reach out to you. One more, like about the longevity, like let's talk about that a little bit, about what people can expect even out of their, you know, $300-$500 boots. Because I think a lot of people are mystified that they could wear through a pair of boots in a season when they've spent that much money.
You have two or potentially three categories of users. You've got the super user. This is your outfitter or people like yourselves that have the opportunity to hunt basically from mid-August to December, hard, multiple hunts. Those people typically recognize, and especially guides and outfitters, because those people look at it's just part of the work. It's part of my uniform, if you will. And so those people often recognize, hey, man, I'm using these things day in, day out. It's paying. My investment is repaid to me on a daily basis. So my cost per use ends up being I love to look at cost per use on all my gear, from my ski gear to my hunting gear. So cost per use gets down to, we're talking like 20 cents, 30 cents per use, 50 cents, maybe on a $500 pair of boots, maybe the guy's getting down to $1, a dollar and a half per use. And they have to recognize, like, would I pay $1.50 for that day to have that kind of comfort in my foot? And knowing that I'm going to retire these at some point. Then you have your second group of people that I'm skipping one, that is, they're going to buy a boot and they're going on one hunt a year, maybe two. They might hunt hard, they might hunt soft, but they know that that boot, they're expecting that boot to last them 6 to 8 to 10 years. And the majority of those boots will last 6 to 8 to 10 years. And there's a partnership. I mean, people have to recognize if you're going to buy something like that, an investment, there's a partnership that needs to happen. That means you take care of your boot and your boot takes care of you. And if it's a one-sided relationship, then usually those relationships go bad, not just in footwear, but in life. But you got
to change your oil in your truck too, by the way.
Yeah, dude, if that light comes on or that up there on the left, the Jiffy Lube thing says like 20,000 miles ago, then you need a citation written. So that group typically is satisfied with their purchase. The super heavy user group is satisfied with the longevity of the boot typically. It's the group in the middle, the guys like probably like me, I hunt 4 or 5 hunts a year. Maybe guys that hunt weekends, throughout most of the season, and they invest in the boot and they're expecting, like, I don't hunt, I'm not a super user, so they're expecting the boot to last 8 to 10 years as well. But the reality is depending upon use, terrain, how well you're taking care of the boot after each use or kind of attending to, its needs, that boot probably is going to last 4 or 5 years on the high, on maybe 6 years on the high end, 2 years on the low end. And that's where you get guys that'll say, man, there's a bit of a rub. And there has to be, from a manufacturer standpoint, we absolutely look at, like, we'll look at each case typically, and most manufacturers do this, say, man, yeah, that boot shouldn't have come apart at that, in that location, or that boot, that sole shouldn't have separated at that location. But then sometimes when you flip it over and you look at the bottom boot, you're like, oh my gosh, dude, these are like moccasins. There's zero tread left. You've destroyed these things. And they're like, oh, I just hunt, every once in a while. You're like, no, you don't. Either that or you're using them on your day job as a plumber or as a concrete layer, and you're on concrete all day long with that soft Vibram sole. So the longevity question is, if I was to say, I'm going to buy a pair of boots and I'm a kind of a weekend with the occasional 1 week in Wyoming hunt, I'm coming out from Missouri to hunt west, and then I'm using it here and there, and I might be using it on, setting trail cameras. I think with any good high-end boot, you should anticipate anywhere from that 3 to 6 year window, and potentially longer depending on how, where you store it and other things like that. And sometimes, quite frankly, it's just like cars or electronics, you do get a lemon. And you just, and hopefully whatever manufacturer you're working with would recognize, like, hey, that's an anomaly, and let's take care of you in that situation. And that's where some of that angst exists, both the people against our brand as well as other brands. But that's the user group that I see that has the most challenge with the longevity question. I don't know if that answered that, Giannis, or gave you some perspective.
That was a great answer, Kendall. I'm very impressed by that answer. I especially like the cost per use analysis and viewpoint that you can take to look at it, because I've never thought about my gear that way. And I'm going to go down to my gear shed right now and start looking at stuff and see if I can put like a monetary value on like per use on it. Cause that's a very interesting way. And it makes sense, because then everybody's going to get, let's say, 300 days out of the boots. You might just do it in 1 year's time. Someone else might do that in 5 years' time, and someone else might do it in 10 years' time. And as long as you take care of them in between the uses, then I think that everybody will still get their 300 days. It just depends on how long you take to get there. And that's no different than putting miles on your car or miles on your tires, right? Everybody's going to get 50,000. Just some people might do it in a year.
Some people might do it in 10, you know, it's the one other thing,
totally.
And I don't want to derail this or go too much longer, but one other thing you have to think about on time of footwear, just like a car tire. Like if you have a trailer out back and you have a tire on it and it, you might only use it once a year, but 7 years later, it's like, dude, this tire's coming apart. Or it's in footwear, the same thing happens. It's a process called hydrolysis. And what happens is a boot, if you store a boot over a long period of time and that boot goes hot, cold, or maybe it changes humidity multiple times and it's just kind of sitting there, you might get occasional use. Those glues and the other things, regardless of the manufacturer, start to undergo a process called hydrolysis, which breaks down the bonding within those different layers. And you may see premature cracking of the leather, for example, or premature separation where there's glue points in whatever footwear. If that's, you know, hey, I've only had these 6 years and I barely use them and what the heck, that could happen. So just a little asterisk or caveat there.
No, I think most people would look at it because they would see it in the form of dry leather, right? Where, I was on a snowy wet hunt last December and then I threw those boots in the closet or wherever and then I pulled them back out in September and boy, they don't look like they were when they were new. It's
or they don't feel like they used to, right?
Right. Yeah, they don't flex like they used to. We're going to cover that topic on an upcoming Gear Talk podcast. But Kendall, thanks, man. That was super informative.
You bet.
Super. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on. I love talking about gear, as you can tell.
Awesome.
Okay, who do I need to talk to see if I can get a pair of crispy boots from Crispy US?
Jordan has my contacts, but just search us up at crispyus.com. But love to get your feet into some and see if they're good for your feet.
Yeah, I'd love to try them. All right, signing off until next time, Jordan. Do we need to add anything right now at the end here?
I don't think so. Just if anybody has questions, send them to geartalk@themeateater.com or go to themeateater.com and find our Gear Talk tab under podcasts. And then under this specific episode, you can scroll down and you can comment on the specific episode and we'll get back with you.
Yeah. And as of this, as of recording today, we've yet to have any comments on our first three released episodes. So please, someone be the first one. Go to, like Jordan said, meteor.com, find this particular episode and comment there. And the cool thing about that is that it'll be a little bit forum-like where you can see other people's comments and we can get a little bit of a conversation rolling and anything goes there. So please use that and it'll help us make a better podcast.
Cool.
Thanks again for listening and we'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.